Hi, Jim.
Hi, Maeve.
I hope you're doing okay over there.
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm rattled.
Oh, no.
I just was outside putting the hens down to their hen run, including, you know, James Hamlin the hen. And there's a bloody dead blackbird right in front of our porch. And I was...
This is Social Distance, the Atlantic's podcast about the pandemic. I'm Jim Hamblin, a doctor and a staff writer with The Atlantic.
And I'm Maeve Higgins, a comedian and a writer, currently kind of worried about something that's outside my home. Is that okay to put that in? Because it's very much on my mind.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like it's central to your identity at this point. Sorry, there's a dead crow?
A little blackbird, I think, because it has an orange beak and the little legs, so...
Oh, that's very sad.
I know, and it's also so sinister because... I didn't have time to look it up, but I think it means there's going to be a murder.
What?
There's some symbolism.
No.
If there's a dead bird, like, right at your front door.
Yeah.
It means something is going to happen. And I'm not superstitious. This is just, you know.
That's just a basic fact.
Yeah. And I'm so freaked out. So I think he died naturally. I don't know. As I said, I was carrying two hens at that time. So... I got a fright and I like kind of squashed them, but they were fine. So they were squawking and then he didn't budge and his little legs are straight up and like it's like a cartoon of a dead bird. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think maybe he died by flying into the window or something.
Usually that's, yeah. I mean, I'm not a bird doctor, but that is usually my first assumption.
It's a similar, you know, physiology as why you have studied. It's like legs, body.
I think the only big difference is they have hollow bones.
Really?
Otherwise, yeah. Yeah, that's how they're able to fly. I mean, that's what I understand. Again, we have been a bird podcast for quite a while, in fact. I don't know if you listen. There's an episode where we actually went birding in Prospect Park.
Yeah, Catherine. Yeah. No, totally. I mean, this has just happened. Should I do a little CPR or a little mouth-to-mouth on him? But...
I think it's gone. Yeah.
You think he's gone because I told you because it's like his legs are sticking up?
Yeah, that's diagnostic. In terms of bird CPR, when you encounter a bird in that position, you don't try anything heroic.
Okay, well, I'll just wait till my dad comes back to move the body.
Yeah, no, you shouldn't have to mess with something like that. That's definitely a good job for dad.
But, you know, I'm glad to get to talk to you as a distraction from all this real stuff that's happening. And I hope, you know, I hope, Jim, you appreciate that I make a bird's death about me. And that's what humans do. We We're at the center of our own story all the time.
I'm just glad you didn't drop the hens.
I am as well. Can you imagine that, like, I accidentally killed two hens because I got a fright because I saw one dead blackbird?
Yeah.
What a mess. I think in service to our listeners and to me, I read your piece, which was about vaccinating children. And, you know, it's been said often, Jim, that you look like a child. They call you Babyface Hamblin. You're very young looking, but you're an adult. But you still saw fit to write about this very important topic.
Yeah, someone has to. And so I figured, why not me? Because I have this childish bearing, I guess. I keep seeing people saying, like, kids don't get that sick. Mm-hmm. It's not that big a deal. You know, things can reopen as soon as, like, the adults are vaccinated. And without a clear plan for how you navigate kids potentially getting sick. And I've just been curious about what that will look like in the coming year, because we won't have vaccines for kids for quite some time.
The problem with it for me was I was thinking about it relatively. So I was thinking, oh my God, like all of these people have died. Say in the US, you know, over 500,000 people have died. The number of children that have died is small compared to that. But that's like such a bizarre way of thinking about it, right? Because in your piece, what I read was, well, hundreds of children have died from a preventable illness.
Yeah.
What's now preventable? And that really kind of opened my eyes up to like, oh yeah, my God, like we need to talk about vaccines for our children.
Yeah. It's interesting because in an absolute way, it's a terrible toll. And roughly 28,000 hospitalizations in the U.S. alone of kids, and about a third of them are ending up in the ICU. You know, that's not a small thing, especially, you know, as a young person, I have to go to the ICU. That's like a life-defining experience. Right. And relative to adults, it's small. So I think when you're in an acute crisis, you kind of just prioritize the biggest threat. And as that threat is attenuated by vaccines, now we start to look at the also very real threat to children. And I talked to some pediatricians and tried to understand, you know, exactly how they're thinking about the coming months where we might have vaccines for adults and not for kids. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of most of the world, still not vaccines for adults, but specifically in the U.S.
Specifically in the U.S., yeah. And there is the news that the Pfizer vaccine, is now going for approval for 12 and up?
Yeah, they will be soon. They have found in their ongoing clinical trial that it seems that kids between 12 and 15 were having immune responses that were productive. So they're just looking for, you know, do kids get this immune reaction that looks similar to adults? They're not actually following through because the disease is relatively rare in kids. I mean, even with tens of thousands of hospitalized, still relatively rare compared to adults. So in order to do a proper clinical trial, you'd have to wait a long, long time in order to, you know, wait for the outcomes, wait for a certain number of kids to get sick. And there's an interesting ethical dilemma there when you have a vaccine that very likely will work in kids. Mm-hmm. You know, do you wait a year to prove that outcome, or do you just look at this intermediary point where it seems like, yeah, it's having a similar effect in the kids who got the vaccine as in adults who got the vaccine, so we're going to go ahead and get it out there and get kids protected. So they're just kind of titrating, like, what is the right dose for kids where they're going to not have too many side effects but are going to be protected.
Oh, is that what it is? Because I was thinking, like, how ignorant am I? But I was just like, do they need to test this literally because kids have smaller bodies than grown-ups? But there's more to it, isn't there? Or that's,
I mean, that's the fundamental thing. I mean, they're not there's this refrain in pediatrics that's like, kids are not just tiny adults,
right?
You know, I mean, that applies to parenting across the board. There are all kinds
that's
of different things.
You can't like make them work, and that's why it's funny if you put them in a suit and glasses, but because they're not.
No, they're not. They have weird feet that need to be trimmed so they can fit into shoes. I think, no, but it's more like a food or like a vitamin C. It's not like a kid is going to react violently to this compound that adults, you know, tolerate quite well. It's more just like there might be different effects at different doses and smaller bodies that we need to be aware of, but it's not going to be like it's this whole different entity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. They're the same species.
Yeah. The way people have been doing it is just by working their way down. I mean, it was already, the initial clinical trials included 16 and up. And so the studies have just gone and are doing progressively younger people. And so far seem reassuring and good. But even still, we're looking at fall to early 2022 for all the young people in the U.S. to have access to vaccines. One of the people who I spoke to was Dr. Jill Foster. She's a pediatrician in Minnesota. She is a professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School, a specialist in pediatric infectious disease. And I would love to talk more about what she's seeing in terms of sick kids and the prospect for vaccination.
When you interview pediatricians, do you put on a baby voice?
No, but they're just very nice people. Pediatricians are.
Are they?
Yeah, tend to be.
I mean, it makes sense to me, but what doctors are mean surgeons?
Without going there, that's a great question. I think the pediatrics self-selects for people who kind of have a lot of patience and really want to take the time out of their day to make a kid smile or laugh.
Excellent. You still have her number?
Well... let me see here. Hi, Dr. Foster.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
Hi, Dr. Foster. It's Maeve, Jim's co-host.
Please feel comfortable to call me Jill.
Okay. Thank you, Jill.
Thanks. Okay.
For our listeners, could you just say your title and a bit about what you do?
I'm Jill Foster. I'm a professor of pediatrics and a pediatric infectious disease physician, and have been through most of my career working around vaccines and working around issues, a lot of them around HIV, of why is it that we have great things that either the public doesn't use or doesn't know about, and that's really been the focus of my work.
Well, it's quite crucial at a moment like this. I wanted to start by talking about kind of what you're seeing clinically, because I think through most of the pandemic, the message to the public has been that kids don't get that sick, because it's been put in relative terms, relative to adults. And indeed, the numbers are much better in kids. But now that vaccines are rolling out among adults, more people are starting to, you know, raise the question of what happens to unvaccinated kids in this time period while adults are vaccinated and kids aren't. So you've taken care of your share of kids who have had severe cases of COVID, is that right?
Both COVID and then the syndrome called MISC that comes after COVID in children, where they've recovered from COVID and then within couple weeks to a month later, they develop a inflammatory syndrome that is often even worse than the COVID.
MISC, which is multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children?
Yes.
it's quite a vague title.
It is.
It means inflammation in many systems.
That sounds horrifying.
Yeah.
I presume it's you don't know that it's going to come, right? Like you get COVID, you get better, and then what happens?
You know, it's interesting. It's similar to another disorder that's called Kawasaki syndrome, which most people, unless they know somebody who've had it, don't have that too. And you know, and what it appears is that there's some trigger. In this case, it's clearly the COVID that gets the immune system all revved up. And so you want the immune system revved up somewhat to fight the COVID, but then a lot of people, it overreacts even during the COVID. But in kids, it appears that a couple weeks later, you know, it kind of lies dormant just waiting to cause trouble. And then a couple weeks later, the immune system starts attacking the person. And the problem with MISC particularly is it starts attacking the arteries in the heart. So the kids come in with a fever and they feel bad all over. A lot of them have abdominal pain, frequently also have a rash. And those are the things that should really cause alarm in parents if their child after COVID starts having a fever and abdominal pain and a rash. They should definitely see their physician. And then we do the further testing. We do an echocardiogram of the heart and find that their coronary arteries are dilated and potentially damaged.
God.
Yeah. Speaking of terrifying parents. So the overall, you know, rate of that happening among kids compared to what we're seeing in adults is still relatively low. How are you advising parents who might be vaccinated themselves or going to be soon and would like to kind of, you know, have family gatherings or travel, get back to, you know, quote unquote, normal life this summer in a period when kids will not have access to vaccines yet?
So what I'm saying is, that, you know, the vaccine gives us an extra measure of safety. Most kids, you know, 16 and up can get vaccine, but under 16 can't get vaccine. So, you know, by immunizing all the adults, we at least have taken a lot of the risk out, but, you know, we haven't taken all of the risk out. So people tend to think, you know, sort of an all or nothing. But what it is it's less risky, but it's still risky enough that people still need to be a little careful. You know, wear your mask, keep your distance, you know, use hand sanitizer. But, you know, I do think that families can gather again as long as they're, you know, a little careful.
Earlier, we mentioned the Pfizer news, you know, that their vaccine, it's so far been safe for kids like between 12 and 16. Did that strike you as big news? And if so, like the timeline, say like the summer, like how did it change your thinking?
Yeah, I think that is big news. And mm-hmm. what I'm really hoping is I'm hoping that, you know, the same way all of this has been rolled out is, you know, first we roll it out, you know, for one group and then we roll it out for another group. And so mm-hmm. I'm really hoping that, you know, the data is reviewed and then there's, you know, this new age group will get rolled into eligibility. I think when people hear children are less at risk and children don't mm-hmm. transmit, they tend to think about, you know, a 2-year-old the same way as an 18-year-old. And so, you know, a lot of it's related to kind of, you know, body size and the amount of, you know, sort of when you inhale and you exhale, how many, you know, viral particles you exhale. And little kids are only going to exhale a little bit of virus and not very far because they just don't have that much respiratory force. And 16, 17, 18-year-olds, they're going to be just the same as an adult. And so they're going to be just as likely to be able to transmit the virus.
I was an absolutely massive 14-year-old. I was like so big at the time. That rugby player Jonah Lomu was a big deal. I remember my dad saying, "God, you're like the Jonah Lomu of our family." I was like, "Oh, thanks."
I don't know any rugby players.
I just heard a story about a lot of transmissions that were from a soccer game. And so you picture a soccer game and you got a bunch of people, you know, bumping up close to each other. You got a bunch of parents standing on the sidelines close to each other. And then you get a bunch of people that are yelling and cheering. And, it's like the perfect storm for an outbreak. And, you know, it was outdoors. So everyone thought, oh, I don't need to wear a mask. And we're totally safe outdoors. And
wow. That's rare. You do not see much transmission happening outdoors.
Unless you have people standing right next to each other for 2 hours, you know, yelling.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Speaking of respiratory force, also, I have heard some very small kids be quite loud when they want to be.
That's true.
But you just mean kind of in general when they're passively breathing and all. We know that kids can transmit, but are less likely, much less likely than an adult to transmit the virus. But then as you get into the teenage years, it becomes comparable to an adult in terms of risk of transmission.
Yes.
Okay.
And I worry about the teenagers because they're more free to roam than the little kids. So you take the little kids on vacation with you, pretty much they're going to stay close to you and you can kind of keep track of them. But the teenagers are, you know, teenagers are natural risk takers and, you know, they're going to be, you know, out of your sight. And as soon as they're out of your sight, they're probably going to pull their mask off and they're going to go hang with friends and new friends they've met on vacation or from all sorts of different places where people don't wear their masks. And so that makes them additionally at risk.
Yeah.
This might be kind of obvious, but like, do children need to be vaccinated to reach herd immunity?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we definitely do.
They do.
Yep.
Just numbers.
See, no hesitation there.
Yep.
I like that. But theoretically, if all the adults, if we got to 100% of adults and 100% of teenagers, it would be essentially zero risk to kids, right?
It would be if you could say that 100% of the vaccine was effective.
Sure.
And that if it was effective 100% of the time. So we're starting to get information now, sort of looking at the vaccine breakthroughs a little bit closer, because some people are, you know, that 95% number, there's still going to be 5%. And it appears, you know, very early information that those 5% are people that had, you know, pretty heavy exposure. So it was somebody who, you know, they themselves got vaccinated, but then they go home to a household full of people that have COVID and are around them all the time. Or, you know, somebody that, you know, was at the soccer game for 2 hours having somebody screaming next to them. It's not going to be perfectly protective.
Got it. So all the more reason that we need to think about this in terms of herd effect. So if you're vaccinated and you're in a very low exposure environment where everyone else is vaccinated, your risk is essentially zero. But if you're vaccinated and you're walking around with tons of contagious people around you, you are still at risk.
Yes.
We had a lot of listener questions, actually, from parents asking about kids and COVID. So I wonder, could you give us some guidance with your pediatrician hat on?
Sure, the best I can.
Okay. So Poppy and Todd are parents of a 7-year-old, and they asked, could you talk about what is known about the new variants of the virus affecting children? We've seen more than one news story about significant increases in children in ICUs. So, in your experience, have the variants made things worse for children? Is it more transmissible? Is it more harmful?
Yes. That's what I'm hearing from my colleagues. I'm hearing more kids are coming in and being hospitalized and more kids are getting sicker from it. And clearly, you know, none of these kids are immunized. One of the things that the variants do is that they spread a lot easier. So I think people, you know, since we've been doing this for a year, had a pretty good sense of what they could do and what they couldn't do. Where you could get away with, you know, not wearing a mask, where you could get away with sort of, you know, traveling where you couldn't before. And I think the variant, because it spreads so much easier, is, you know, breaking into that complacency a little, because it does spread it easier. So the things that we've all been doing of kind of cheating a little bit over the last year, yeah, you can't cheat anymore.
People get used to going to a store or something and wearing a bad mask. And just because it's happened safely for the past 8 months doesn't mean it would continue to in the presence of variants.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so the big question that people have been debating throughout the course of the pandemic has been schools. Does anything about this combination of variants, no pediatric vaccines yet available, is in terms of where we stand right now, are you still optimistic that schools will be able to be open in person in the fall?
Yeah, I think that story is yet to be written. Based on where we go over the next couple of months of schools. Now that, you know, we have the variants in a lot of places are 40 to 60% of the infections, and we'll see how it goes in schools. You know, so much of the controls over this is sort of like a thermostat. You turn it up a little, you turn it down a little. You know, right now, you know, the caution level got turned down a fair amount, and, you know, we're trying the schools. And I think we had to try the schools. You know, there's so many issues, both for the kids not being in schools and for the parents not being able to do what they need to do because their kids aren't in schools.
Yeah.
We had to try it. And I think the next 2 months will inform what we need to do in the fall.
Jim, you'll have to go and investigate that one. That sounds like an assignment. She's like, that story has to be written. It's like, Jim, you have to write it.
Well, I'll be keeping an eye on it. But I'm wary of this message that people think that once the adults are vaccinated, we can totally remove all caution and restrictions. And I think, yeah, that's a dangerous idea if people aren't aware that many thousands of kids have been hospitalized, many of them in the ICU.
Right. And the fact that, you know, not all adults have been vaccinated.
Some don't want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a message maybe, Dr. Foster, to the adults who are hesitant about vaccination in light of many vulnerable kids?
You know, it's the same message that, you know, I try to have an outlook that I love the hesitant rather than refusing, that it's that someone has just not yet agreed to have the vaccine, that there's something that they're waiting for that will either relieve their anxiety over it or something that will lead them to feel that it is compelling, either compelling for themselves or compelling for others in society of, you know, hey, I need to get vaccinated so that kids can get back to school and life can get back to normal, even if I'm feeling pretty good about my situation right now, is what I'm hoping we could get more people to. I think the vaccine's been out long enough now, and we've not seen anything horrible happen. The people should feel pretty, you know, the people in the beginning were like, oh, I don't want a new vaccine. It's not a new vaccine at this point. And I think people should feel pretty comfortable getting it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the point has been made a lot, but that these vaccines draw on technology that's been developed over decades.
We keep hearing about sort of minorities folks being hesitant. And, you know, we have not found, you know, again, our communities in Minnesota, but in communities where people are well-informed, there's not a lot of hesitancy. And that, you know, you open up a place where they can easily get vaccine at a convenient time, and people are flooding into the vaccine, you know, centers. So.
Right. Can I ask specifically about the nature of hesitancy among parents vaccinating kids? From some of the polling that I've seen, people seem more willing to take a vaccine themselves and seem more hesitant about the possibility of vaccinating their child for complex reasons. I don't know how that'll actually bear out once, you know, the vaccines are available, but do you think people approach that decision differently? And is there anything helpful to consider in why people might weigh risks differently when thinking about their own bodies versus their child?
I think that's a great question. I think parents in general are, you know, feel that they have a responsibility to protect their children. I think, you know, everything is about, you know, risk versus benefit. And I think a lot of people out there really view that there is very little risk to their child. They've read the stories of, oh, it's no more than a cold, it's asymptomatic. You know, I kind of look at it as kind of like a seatbelt. You know, most parents, they, you know, they buckle their kids into either their seatbelt or their car seat, you know, even though there's a very tiny chance of having an accident on a given day. And, you know, vaccines are the same way. Even if you're not going to look at it for, you know, the broad population of protecting, you know, and getting to herd immunity on something, it's I think that parents need to think of it that way.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. That's like we were speaking with an ethicist, our Kaplan, and he used a similar analogy. He was kind of talking about people who are like, you can't tell me what to do with my body. But like, you know, all of us follow the rules of the road and use seatbelts. And, you know, it's like, just in case, it's just part of life and it's fine.
Yeah.
I was going to ask as well about, you know, this big toll that the pandemic has taken on parents and on children and on their mental health. You know, the stress that the families have been under has been just massive. Have you met with this? And, you know, how do you offer advice and help to patients when they talk about this problem?
It's a huge problem. You know, I was talking to somebody who takes care of very young children, infants. And, you know, talking about how these infants, you know, the first year of life is when you, you know, kids, their brains are developing and they're learning how to be social. And you have infants who've not seen another stranger outside of their household for a whole year, you know, and how's going to that going to impact them long term? I think for parents, this has been so hard. And, you know, I encourage all people that are not only a parent, but are, you know, somebody who can control some environments in a workplace is, you know, give some, you know, empathy and compassion to your employees. I saw one Zoom thing. It was like, make sure your children aren't in the Zoom and make sure there's never a dog barking in the background and those types of things. And like, you know, like you got to accept that once in a while, a child in a dinosaur costume is going to wander into your professional Zoom meeting. It just happens.
I would do more than accept that. That's wonderful.
Yes, I know. I thought it was wonderful, but I'm a pediatrician.
So you're a good person. Yeah. No, I mean, the more dogs and kids, the better. I hope that stays a feature.
We all have to be more forgiving of each other and give more compassion to each other. And it's there's so many things that people have just like moved into their fighting corners with their boxing gloves up. And we just, you know, it's kind of understandable. But at the same time, people need to just chill a little bit.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. I'm so glad that you said that in an actual prescriptive way. And I'm going to be repeating that.
Yeah.
I was talking to a doctor and she said, everyone needs to chill. Thank you so much for your insight today. It's really helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to.
Take care.
Bye.
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 Jim, you were so right about pediatricians being the coolest.
Yeah. Yeah, generally. Very, very nice. And I want to say, you know, Maeve, I think we have a lot of teens who listen to the show, particularly cool teens, and just don't, you know, don't go off away from your parents, take your mask off. It's not cool. It doesn't make you hip. It doesn't make you groovy or with it. You know, still be careful, especially if you have younger siblings and if you can't get vaccinated yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's not worth the TikToks.
Shout out to our teens, our teen listeners. We know you're there. And you're here for Jim, the coolest, oldest brother you could ever imagine.
they come for the bird content.
Yeah, they do. Big ornithology heads. That's really huge amongst 15-year-olds at the moment.
Well, hopefully we will talk more and acknowledge, I guess, the reality of the risks to young people. And if anyone out there is on the fence living their life and feeling at low risk and like they're a healthy young adult or something and wouldn't really mind if they got sick and they hate shots, so they're not going to do it because all the other adults are going to do it. Remember, there's a bunch of kids, all of them, young people who simply cannot. And every transmission puts them at some risk. And just because their risk is lower than an adult does not mean it's at all zero. Like, Maeve, if this were just a disease that only affected children, it would be making headlines on its own. Like 28,000 kids, 28,000 American kids have been hospitalized with this. It would be a huge story. And so hopefully that comes to the fore. It doesn't mean we can't have schools or kids can't socialize. It just means we still need to think about how that's happening for a little while longer.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you, Jim. I mean, if that was another thing, like, you're right, like, thousands and thousands of kids ending up in hospital. That's so scary when you're small. Like, I just had to go to hospital like twice when I was a kid, not for big deal stuff.
That's so scary, especially. I mean, if you're scared to go, like, have the doctor give you a shot as a kid, the fear of, like, having an IV and, like, potentially being on a ventilator, having to, you know, have supplemental oxygen, people, you know, like, being in a hospital where probably your parents can't come, or it's very restricted if they can.
Did you ever go to hospital when you were small?
I didn't have to. No, I was spared of that. I broke my thumb once after pitching the championship game in my little league series. I fell at the party after the team party after I broke my thumb.
Oh no!
I know.
Wait, did you have a cast that made you do the thumbs up all the time?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, just so positive. Such a positive injured child.
It was a great weapon.
Oh, because it was it old fashioned, like, heavy
thing? Yeah, a hard plaster one. Yeah, you could really punch with it.
A little Dennis the Menace.
Maeve, before we go, I had a question about a thing that you wrote about called Outlander, and I haven't seen it. But it's a popular TV show.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need to talk about this. It's this, but yeah. I wrote a piece about it.
The star of the show tweeted about your take on it.
Yeah. So Outlander is a show on Starz. It's about time travel. There's a lot of sex in the show. There's a lot of really ludicrous adventures and shipwrecks and, like, people losing their minds and, you know, the Highlands of Scotland and, yeah. Two husbands. Anyway, it's a crazy show that has been very enjoyable during lockdown. And I wrote about it, and this piece got shared, like, a lot online. And I didn't realize the fandom attached. Like, have you ever even heard of the show, Jim?
I've heard of it, but I feel like it's just having a moment right now. It's in its third season, you say?
No, there's five seasons of it.
Five seasons?
Like, yeah. And
then why right now? Is everyone desperate for escape?
I think it's a real escapist show, but there's been these fans there, like, all along since, I don't know, like, for years, because the books came out in 1990. And so then they all, like, you know, started talking to me online about, like, how I needed to focus more on the male lead, who's, like, the hottest guy in the world, apparently. So, I'm in trouble with a whole lot of Outlander fans at the moment. So it's probably why the dead bird is outside my house.
Oh, that explains it. Yeah, when you write about fantasy stuff that has a real hardcore following, you know, good luck. You dipped your toe into treacherous waters.
I did not know that rule.
Yeah. Oh, man, if I were to mention Star Wars or something, I would need to be very cautious, I think.
You really do. And you'd have to talk about, like, Captain Picard or whatever, because otherwise they'd be so mad at you.
All right. That I think we're already we need to recall what was just said. I don't know what was the best captain. It's not as straightforward for me as talking about, you know, viruses.
It's not your wheelhouse.
Well, viruses are just these mechanical forces. They just, like, do the same thing in every cell, and it's actually quite predictable. It's we who cannot control them. It's we who are the variables, Maeve.
That sounds science fiction-y to me.
Next week on Star Outlander Bird Wars. I'm
There's
losing
no
it.
Greater distance. Okay, let's do the...
the social distance.
Social Distance is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from senior producer AC Valdez. We love hearing from listeners. If there's something you'd like us to talk about on an upcoming show, our email is socialdistance@theatlantic.com. And our voicemail line is 202-642-6487.
And as always, if you like this show and want access to all of The Atlantic's journalism, the best way to do that is by subscribing at theatlantic.com/support us. Take care, Maeve.
Bye. Thanks a million, Jim.